So is this inversion of reality associated with people's loss of meaning? And does this explain why, according to a WHO statistic, depression is the most common disability worldwide and still rising? I think it does. So what do we do about this? To conclude the chapter on personal corruption, how can we, who live more or less in touch with the modern world, try to escape the pernicious effects of this kind of twisted value system? Well, as much as you can, avoid making judgments based on money. Certainly avoid idolizing it and steer clear of any incitement to do so. So conspicuous consumption, lotteries, adverts in general, mass media, game shows, I mean, these are all very toxic things, and we should not go near them as far as we possibly can. Now, to move on, looking at social corruption. We've looked at how money affects individual psyches, but of course, it takes all sorts of people to make a world, and some are more selfish than others, and yes, 1% of people are psychopaths, and other people may be psychotic or near psychotic if they are that focused on money. As an example of what I'm talking about, this is the psychosis of money, as quoted by David Corton, quote, "The minister responsible for Malaysia's forests explained that since money grows faster than trees, Malaysia will be better off once it has cut down all its trees and put the money in the bank to earn interest," unquote. If you are a lover of trees, you do not want to hear that your forest minister believes he should cut down all the trees. Now, I don't know the motives or the education of the chap concerned, but if you approach the decision as an economist, that might very well be the case. You're handing over control to the bankers, but I can certainly see how on a balance sheet that assertion might be unanswerable. The larger point is the corruption of thinking. Organizations that focus on money lose their own value systems. So as an example of this, you've got the strict father and his worship of market forces, the idea that the market is a replacement father in teaching virtue. Henry Ford said, "I am not in the business of making cars, I am in the business of making profit." And that's exemplified by the Ford Pinto, a model of car released in the 1970s. And one drawback of the Ford Pinto was that rear collisions of over 30 miles per hour had an unfortunate combination. Firstly, they jammed the passenger doors, and secondly, exploded the gas tank. So a lot of people were incinerated in accidents in Ford Pintos as a result. Now, Ford had already established this was a problem, but went ahead and released the car. And when asked to explain how they arrived at this decision, good economists that they were, they showed that they had applied a cost-benefit analysis. They had asked how cheaply this deficit could be remedied. Answer: a piece of rubber could be used to prevent the gas tank from igniting, which would cost about $6 per car, for every car they made, as opposed to how they expressed it as the cost of the death to them, which was about $200,000 in lawsuits from victims. And that's $200,000, but a relatively small number of victims compared to the number of cars. So it was more cost-effective to make defective cars. The two value systems were at odds. Are they trying to make the best cars? No, they're trying to make the most money. The next example by which systems are corrupted is that Ford were charged with reckless homicide, that they knowingly produced a dangerous product and didn't inform anybody about it, and the judge acquitted them. He didn't dispute the reckless homicide, but he said that Ford could not be convicted for doing what it was designed to do, making a profit. So not only was the car company corrupted by money, in the sense that making good cars was not what they were about, they were making money. The legal system had a statute of reckless homicide to prevent homicides from occurring, but when push came to shove, and the interests of big business were at stake, then the judge caved. So, in fact, preventing crimes was not what it was about. As another example, in the Gospel of Matthew again, Jesus is reported as saying, "It is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, the Roman Catholic Church, supposedly built on the teachings of Jesus Christ, by the 13th century, had an industry going. Popes were selling what they called indulgences, which I guess is a kind of a euphemism. It meant that for rich people who were busy making money, too busy, in fact, to bother praying for their own soul, for a price, then members of the Catholic Church would step in and pray for them. So the original message of Christ, that it's hard for the rich to get to heaven, was turned round 180 degrees. The school system, as we've looked at just recently, I had to try and summarize this in one slide, not to go into it in too much detail. President Woodrow Wilson is quoted as saying, "We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks." Unquote. That was at the start of the 20th century, nearly 100 years ago, that he was reported as saying that what was called education was basically training people to do difficult tasks for money, not for love. If more people nowadays paid attention to such historical notes, then they could save themselves a lot of grief and a lot of misplaced effort trying to keep schools running. But no, it's too difficult for them to challenge what they think they know, what they think they've been taught. The next slide is called astroturfing. In case you don't know, astroturf is fake turf. You roll it out to measure, and in the same way, astroturfing by organizations is a fake grassroots. So the Save Our Species Alliance, SOSA, has a logo involving the USA and a fish and a couple of birds flying across it, and this is from their earlier website, now taken down. You can read about them on Wikipedia. It says, quote, "We are a nationwide grassroots organization comprised of property owners, farmers, ranchers, miners, foresters, builders, developers, sportsmen, recreationists, business owners, and ordinary citizens." No mention there of the timber industry. In fact, it was set up by the timber industry in an effort to oppose environmental protection laws. But they call themselves the Save Our Species Alliance. Now, how could you find that out? Well, if you followed the money, that's where does their funding come from, you would find this curt statement: "This corporation was incorporated in the state of Delaware. Names of the contributors under Delaware state law cannot be revealed to any other party." So, looks like a full stop if you're trying to follow the money. But that, of course, is how money works. If somebody has money, you can't inquire about where their money came from. As an ordinary citizen, your choice is only whether or not to take their money and do their bidding. Now, those organizations with the most money will be those organizations which have concentrated on making money, and therefore those organizations which have given second priority, or which have completely ignored, their mandate, their stated mission. As another example of how the public discourse is corrupted, if you've ever used the term litter lout, then this, you need to know that this was invented by Keep America Beautiful, Incorporated. That sounds fine. That, in fact, was not a grassroots organization. That was the U.S. manufacturer's effort to promote disposable containers by blaming consumers for waste. So diatribes against litter louts is blaming people for dropping litter. That, of course, got the organizations off the hook for making the litter. The larger model of regulatory capture should be well known to listeners of this show. The nurturing parent, of course, has an impulse to try to make sure everybody is cared for in society, and many government institutions, agencies, claim that they are serving the public. But as long as they are funded and they work by using money, then they are susceptible to control by those who can control the money. That is, many of them, at least, are controlled by big business. And if you're selling drugs and you stand to lose millions of pounds if a certain drug is ruled illegal, or if another drug is ruled legal, then a central point from which all these decisions emanate is a natural thing to want to control. Having a hierarchy makes it much easier, public opinion on what is right and wrong, what is acceptable and not, very difficult to predict, whereas a small centralized agency with rights to decide, much easier to control. The electromagnetic spectrum, radio waves, television waves, X-ray, ultraviolet, and so on, very important for cell phones and potentially huge source of income using this, but limited in the sense that if you have too many electromagnetic signals, they'll interfere with each other. So originally these were managed for the public good, and there was a bunch of controls, and possibly even democratic controls. I'm not sure to what extent the public interest was actually manifested in their usage, but it's certainly not now, and there's no pretense at this, because the spectrum has been auctioned off. So the highest bidder basically got to use that. So effectively no difference between a company selling off its assets and getting as much as it can for it. So this market logic is applied to ever more of life. Now, this isn't as dramatic as cutting down a forest, but the abandoning of the ideas central to the nurturing parent, central to the caring society. If you have to put things on a left-right spectrum, which I usually don't, you would talk about right rather than left. The agenda of privatizing things, roads, railways, water, prisons, voting, even bioweapons research has partly been privatized. You might think that there were some limits to this. And if you check Adam Smith and other supposed apostles of the free market ideology, then yes, certain issues such as law and order and the enforcing of contracts were deemed to be the inalienable prerogative of non-market systems. However, that seems to have largely been forgotten about in the rush for profits. This slide is entitled Resource Capture. It's a picture of the Pentagon with a reminder that they lost $2.3 trillion as they announced on Monday, the September the 10th, 2001. That's 25% of all the money they ever received. How corrupt can you get? That's taken from a television report in which it said that the money was wasted, which sort of suggests it's like buying food and then it got spoilt, it never got eaten. But to think about wasting $2.3 trillion, I think it's a fair assumption that it got lost, in the sense that it went into pockets other than those for which it had been allocated. Now look at Iraq, which for some years had more mercenaries than regular US soldiers, and they were officially beyond the reach of any law. Now I see a connection here between the strict father model, which says effectively that might is right, albeit measuring right in economic terms. Well, is not far to go from economic power to military force when mercenaries are up for sale. I see this as being linked to the increasing violence in failed states such as the US, which has a quarter of the world's prisoners and half of the world's weapon budget. The idea of government resting on the social contract, social consensus, something which is agreed, is being sidelined in favour of something which is enforced. This is the last slide in the corruption of society section. What could we do about this if more and more of the government bodies, of the agencies, if everything is being reduced to a struggle for money, and those who are corrupted, those organizations which abandon their other purposes and focus on money, if they are the ones which increasingly gain power, then I recommend that we avoid money as far as possible. Work with volunteers where you can, try and avoid any kind of bureaucracy, taxes and regulations. Now, the last section, entitled Global Corruption, the most heavily armed and the most heavily funded organizations are the most psychopathic, and I don't think this is any kind of coincidence. Most national governments are actually almost irrelevant. You look at how easily they are changed and how easily they are manipulated by large, well-funded, psychopathic organizations such as the US military, such as intelligence agencies, and such as drug cartels, other organizations which are largely out of the public discourse. Refer to Peter Dale Scott to discover more of this kind of workings of really big money. So now let's look at the corruption of thinking, how the discourse of international organizations is off the mark. And this is a map of Africa from the World Bank, their development indicators in 2005, and we see that they're still defining poverty in terms of income. So the message then is that monetizing life will reduce poverty. If instead of babysitting the kids for the community for free, if you charge for it, then you're getting an income. So you're lifting yourself out of poverty. And of course, you know, where does that income come from? You've got to get it from other people. They've got to get it. So instead of doing things for you for free, they'll be charging. So if everybody starts charging, everybody's income rises. So according to their definition, then they are fighting poverty by making everybody enter the money system. And that, of course, suits the purposes of the rich who control the money system, who create money out of nothing, and who anyway have a lot more money available. So there may be many good people inside those organizations trying to do the right thing, and if they are fighting poverty as defined by money, then they are encouraging poor people to change their lives in such a way that they're more easily controlled by the rich. So looking at the corruption of the language as evidence of the corruption of thinking. How many times have you heard people say countries in the global south are poor countries, to emphasize their difference of rich countries, not to look at the real world, not to look at how their societies differ, but as if money is what's making the difference. That's encouraging people from so-called rich countries to send money. Now, suspicion about the effect of sending money is one of the things that encouraged me to come to Bangladesh in the first place, and really deserves its own entire show. So I'm not going to go into too much detail there. Now, another example of corruption of language: free trade agreements, or as Teresa Caraggio calls them, free to raid agreements, which I think is a little bit closer to the truth. Now, how free are they if the majority of people in that country don't support it, and it has to be enforced, if it's agreed amongst a small paid-off elite who rule the country? If we call these countries economically underdeveloped, that's kind of presupposing that they need to be economically developed. And we've seen in earlier episodes of Unwelcome Guests what economic development means. It's a change of balance sheet, adding numbers, getting countries into debt. This accounts for economic development, not looking at the effects on people's lives. People may imagine an economically underdeveloped country is like an undernourished child, that it needs to have more development, the way that a child needs food to help it to develop. And this is really work for Lakoff, I suppose, to unmask some of these metaphors, some of these misleading parallels that people build in their minds, and that weasel words are used to try to trick people into using. So look at the public mission of the World Bank. What do they say about themselves? Quote, "The World Bank is a vital source of financial and technical assistance to developing countries around the world. Our mission is to fight poverty with passion and professionalism." Unquote. Now, we've had a look at what professionalism is, and what sort of reality do you think is behind the financial and technical assistance to developing countries? Well, this is pointed to John Perkins on Creation of the Debt Crisis. Without knowing that there was a deliberately engineered policy to get these, quote, underdeveloped nations, unquote, into unpayable debt, you can't understand the debt crisis, which is subterfuge to gain control over their economies and resources. Now, earlier I said that these large, well-funded, well-armed organizations are generally psychopathic in nature, and I couldn't find a better way to exemplify this than the infamous Summers memo. This is from Lawrence Summers, who in 1991 was chief economist of the World Bank, and he wrote an internal memo which was leaked, which contained the following quote, "I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. I've always thought that underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted." Unquote. When called to account for what he was talking about, countries in Africa are underpolluted, he pretended that the whole thing was some kind of elaborate joke. Now, I can find no more appropriate comment to make about such a statement than that which was made by José Lutzenberger, Brazil's Secretary of the Environment, who replied, quote, "Your reasoning is perfectly logical, but totally insane. Your thoughts provide a concrete example of the unbelievable alienation, reductionist thinking, social ruthlessness, and arrogant ignorance of many conventional economists concerning the nature of the world we live in." Unquote. Now, Lawrence Summers was not sacked from his job as a result of that internal memo as chief economist, and he has since worked as Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, President of Harvard University, and since 2009, Director of the White House National Economic Council. José Lutzenberger, however, was pressured to quit the following month and never worked in politics again. So, to use a financial metaphor, he paid the price for speaking truth to power, while Lawrence Summers' career appeared to have been undamaged by such blatant disregard for human welfare. Now, this slide, The War on Terror, we've looked at many times, is basically using a phantom enemy to control citizens and boost profits for arms dealers and those who profit when people panic. Israel, of course, has a huge industry based on controlling terrorism. So people are encouraged to feel there's no alternative but paying more taxes to the government to protect them. False flag terrorism we've looked at on the show already in episode 533, how national security services stage a domestic attack as a pretext for a foreign war. If you pay for somebody to protect your house and your house is attacked, then you wouldn't perhaps hand over even more money to the same group of people to keep protecting your house. However, when it comes to the secret agencies, then there is no such discussion. The free market doesn't apply, and you are not within your rights to say, I don't want to pay my taxes to these people because I don't respect what they do, and you can't even find out how much of your tax money goes to fund a lot of this activity because it's off the books. It all adds up to an unaccountable superstructure which is above public scrutiny. We've looked at the Bilderberg meetings. We haven't looked at the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations. Those three always seem to get mentioned together. The Bank for International Settlements, that is, the central banker's central bank. These are extremely powerful institutions which are almost never looked at in commercial media. I mean, the names are not even mentioned. That is how low profile they are. And the World Trade Organization, to some extent, was put on the public map by demonstrations in Seattle. But the Bilderberg meetings still is unknown to many people. So, what should we do about the fact that, globally, the most ruthless and violent organizations are prospering in the money system? My approach has been to seek people who work for love, not for money, to seek organizations which are non-hierarchical, because any kind of money-based hierarchy is subject to bribes, subject to financial coercions, to corruption, in a word. So free yourself from money psychosis as much as possible. Try not to think in money terms. Try and see the world as it actually is. One day it hit me how much tasty fruit I'd eaten, which had been grown in Bangladesh, and the fact that all I'd done was hand over bits of paper. I'd never actually planted any fruit. An imbalance, I thought, which I should try and correct. And that's what got me into permaculture gardening. Could you live without using money, or if the people close to you didn't use money? If the answer is no, then I suggest you take corrective action, and certainly it will correct your focus, and relationships will become much more important. I suggest it would be good preparation for the times ahead in which resource shortages undermine the existence of pounds and dollars and euros and the other centrally issued currencies, which tend to be administered by psychopaths whose greed, as we heard about last show, knows no limits. Now let's return to John Taylor Gatto.
Now think again about the meaning of the American lawsuits. Think of all the broken promises they represent, the cloud of bogus services misrendered for which redress is being offered. Is it just barely possible that the shift after World War II from manufacturing to what is now called a service economy is part of the reason for our visible unhappiness as a nation? Just as the earlier shift from an agricultural economy to a manufacturing one brought a sharp increase in general misery in its wake. Is it just barely possible that when most of us don't accept the obligation of free service to each other as part of the social contract, but instead assign the job to specialists and hired hands, that rather than the joy King Solomon promised us, the payoff is its opposite, grief? Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I do have an interesting bit of recent evidence in support of George Simmel's theory. In 1971, the United States National Book Award which is quite a spectacular prize to win, for nonfiction, went to a book called The Blood Relationship, a book which undertook to explore whether valuable things given to another free were more or less valuable than the same things given for money. The commodity the author took for his test of this proposition was human blood. He made an imaginative cross-national comparison of the quality and the availability of human blood in countries that charge for it, like our own, and in countries like England, where it is given away. Almost all blood in the United States is purchased wholesale and then resold several times for several profits. Almost all blood in England is donated freely and then it is given away for no charge. The book's conclusions aren't the slightest bit ambiguous. Everywhere on the planet where blood is sold, the quality of the blood is terrible. The prices are sky high, the shortages are common, and wherever blood is sold, there is also frequently great danger to the purchaser of the blood. I mean, there's a national scandal now in covering up how many people have gotten AIDS from blood transfusions. But there's an additional intangible cost of selling something like blood. Where blood is bought and sold, the community loses the tradition of giving freely to neighbors and to strangers. And where that tradition is lost, the donors of the blood lose the joy gained from service to the common good. In other words, a social and ethical corrosion ensues from the marketplace in blood. Communities that provide their own blood needs without cost are healthier for that. And in many ways, people seem happier in those communities. Transforming blood into a stuff of commerce is, one, inefficient in economic terms. Two, it's inefficient in supply terms. It's hard to get blood to meet the demand. Where it's given freely, there are seldom shortages of blood. And three, in quality terms, it doesn't add up. The social cost, in addition, is high. U.S. blood, the most heavily commercialized in the world, is also the worst blood supply in the world. The lesson suggested by my mother, by Biblical Solomon, by George Simmel, and by the blood experience, I mean to be a lesson for parents and schools too. When schools consume the youth of the nation in confinement and all the products of all their labors dissolve into paper to be thrown away, there is no joy possible in seeking such a good. The pricing of time through a currency of grade points establishes an irrational medium by which something irretrievable and precious, time itself, is corrupted in service to arbitrary and meaningless urgencies. Experts who are the sellers of school services to government have consistently misdiagnosed and misdefined the problem of schooling. School problem is not the children don't learn to read, to write, and to do arithmetic well. Those deficiencies are directly byproducts of errors of our purpose. The larger problem is that kids hardly learn at all the way schools insist on teaching. Schools desperately need a vision of purpose because the vision they now angrily promulgate is a dishonest one. It was never factually true that young people learn to read or do arithmetic primarily by being taught those things. They are learned, but they are not really taught at all. So all the immense, intricate technology of school product is just so much hokum. Overteaching interferes with learning, although the few who survive the practice may well come to imagine that it was done by an act of teaching, through an act of teaching, that is, that they learned. Colonial America, it is easy to demonstrate, was massively literate without any systematic or compulsion schooling at all. For many decades, an artificially induced hysteria about basic skills has been the cover story behind which we were intimidated into abandoning children to a form of confinement schooling which simply doesn't work. Behind this mask, valuable lessons of service to a vibrant community of real human beings have been denied the young and denied all of us except for school teachers. All of us except for school teachers have been denied healthy interaction with children that adults need in order to remain fresh and vigorous. That's what Rousseau meant when he said you will never get control of the minds of children as long as they mix freely in the community. It's too exhilarating and productive for everyone they mix with. And I believe the same is true of old people as well. You need to confine these groups away in some form of isolation before you can properly treat the residue, the Middle Ages, the most productive workers, that you can properly treat them as instruments. So give and take, take and give. Children desperately need the lessons that volunteer service, apprenticeships, and work study teach, but instead they're kept in holding pens with others of their own age and social class. They are priced and valued according to their ability to adjust to this unhealthy regimen, to remain passive, to take orders, to maintain a cheerful demeanor while their time is being wasted. Children give nothing but are then rewarded for becoming quiet parasites. This has been, I think, the formula producing extended childishness in the outlines of a caste system in the United States, however well it has served the economic institution of mass schooling. After struggling at the bars of the cage for a few years, most kids just give up and settle into the low-grade activities of the school. The relentless rationalization of educational experience to one flavor, confinement schooling, has left the modern student a prisoner in a disenchanted world without meaning. Our cultural dilemma here in the United States has nothing to do with children who don't read very well. And I wrote this speech originally about a year before Hillary Clinton said this. Mrs. Clinton and I are certainly on opposite sides of many issues, but on this we're not. The real dilemma in the United States lies in the difficulty of finding a way to restore meaning and purpose to modern life. There is no point in reading if it seems to lead nowhere. We have progressively stripped children of the primary experience base they need to grow up sound and whole by pricing abstract study higher. The great irony has been that while we devalued service and life experience, abstraction has followed the path that George Simmel predicted it would by being priced. It too matters less and less. The dynamics of this process operate unseen. To begin with, the natural sequence of learning is destroyed without experience, a sequence in which primary data, hands-on experience, must always come first. Only after a long apprenticeship in rich and profound contact with the world, with the home, with the neighborhood and its people, does the thin gas of abstraction mean much to most people. After 26 years of classroom teaching, I slowly realized that what Benjamin Franklin, what he must have realized as a teenager, that only a few of us are fashioned in such a peculiar way that we thrive on an exclusive diet of blackboard work and workbook work and talkbook work. What we fail to take into account is that most children, rich or poor, really learn by involvement, by doing, by independent risk-taking, by shouldering real responsibility and not being parasites, by intermingling intimately in the real world of adults in all its manifestations. When we set up a laboratory universe in which our children are confined with anonymous strangers certified by the state, then we have created in advance a world of failing families, wrecked cities, and blasted individual lives. Then we have created the theater where a mathematical bell curve seems to describe the human condition in which few children have any real talent. This is a colossally cynical act. It is only prolonged in the face of its deadly effects because school factories and all the forces which service them have become an integral part of the money economy. The lie of our own unexamined premises has given us the horrible children we complain of as a nation. Indifferent children, cowardly children, dishonest children, selfish children, children who disrespect their parents and adults in general, who hurt each other, who trample each other's rights in exchange for worthless prizes like blue ribbons or school grades. Eventually, these are the children who grow up to be clients for the nation of lawyers. I'll let you finish the rest of that sentence yourself. Children who will one day break contracts and encroach on the weak if an opportunity arises. And why not? For such is the example that 12 years of schooling has provided. Breaking of contracts, encroaching on the weak. The logic of confinement schooling in the middle of a democracy is a contradiction of our original national character. It breaks the contract of the Bill of Rights, using as its justification that kids can't learn any other way. They just can't be trusted with responsibility, and neither can their parents. And the truth is exactly the opposite of that. Unless they are trusted with responsibility, they cannot learn much, and under the thumb of central compulsion, the lessons they do learn are bad lessons. School encroaches on the right of each new life to test itself against the needs of the real world and to alter those needs by its own investment. Schools are a training ground for irresponsibility because irresponsibility is nearly the only thing they are set up to teach. Schools desperately, as I said, need a vision of their own purpose. At present, they are exactly what many suspect they are. They are government jobs for children, and the worst kind of government jobs, the make-work kind. They're not really jobs at all. There's nothing or very little to do in a school. Our elite high school techs are on the level of fifth-grade readers from 160 years ago. Instead of listening to Mr. Sizer or Mr. Gardner, the Carnegie Corporation, grab yourself a handful of school texts from the days when school wasn't compulsory and look exactly at what's been done to us. It has not happened by accident. And dumbing down the work isn't merely some sinister conspiracy, although certainly it is that too. It has become more and more a necessity as generations of well-schooled children reproduce themselves, become parents, and have nothing to communicate to their own children. So the damage is cumulative, and it is fast becoming insupportable. Look around you at our society. We've created a whirlpool of addiction, and when I use the word addiction, I never think of drug addiction. Addiction's much more unmanageable than drug addiction. Addictions which children and grown children use to avoid confronting themselves with their own uselessness. We are reluctant to face this narcotic reality of our common society because it acts as a criticism revealing much more than we care to face about the real source of our difficulties. We have forced children to become irresponsible for all their natural youth. It is no wonder they hate themselves and hate us. No wonder they cannot recover. If you cut a man's legs off when he is a boy, they will not grow back when he is a man. With the growing public alarm over the effects of science and technology on societies all over the world, we are soon going to have a chance to rethink the basic questions of education, questions which have very little to do with reading, writing, and arithmetic, but much more to do with the fundamental questions of human existence. In what curriculum shall a good life be found? How should we all live? What shall we do with our children? My own suspicion is that systematic government compulsion schooling is doomed. Whether meetings like this occur or not, that it's doomed. There's no way to tinker with this thing to make it work much better than it does already. And soon the monopoly is going to have to be surrendered because it hurts people too much and it is far too expensive. If well-schooled children are the goal, they can be turned out at a fraction of the cost of government-schooled children. John Chubbs of the Brookings Institute responded to charges that breaking the government monopoly would hurt poor children and children of color by producing figures that showed private and parochial schools are far better integrated than the public schools are at about half the cost. But frankly, I don't think the world can afford well-schooled children at all anymore, whether they come from the factories of government, of church, or of private industry. We need a different kind of man and woman to tackle the future, the kind of young people who accept the obligations of living joyfully and with responsibility. To get to this new place, we need a vision of what an education is and what a school should be. Only out of a clearly spoken vision can come the mutual hope we need to find ways to get there. Curriculum is only the Latin word for a race course, the path by which a horse gets to its destination. We have not even begun to agree as a nation on a destination for education that is worthwhile. Beating other countries, scoring well on tests, getting a good job, all these are low evasions of what the human spirit really needs. All are ways to duck the truth that we have failed thus far to pay the price in argument and debate, in agony and in love that a strong vision would cost us. Without a vision, all the talk about reforming curriculum leads nowhere. Unless we can convince ourselves, our children included, that the new course is worth following, it will not work any better than the old course did. And why should it? A political state, by its very nature, provides a vision that misfits human nature. States are exercises in power and coercion, not exercises in wisdom. If we learn to read better and were given time to reflect in our youth, I think we would all realize this. A vision, certainly the people who founded this country and gave us the Bill of Rights understood that clearly, that the state was no guarantee of your rights, but just the reverse. That's why schools aren't mentioned at all in the Bill of Rights or the Constitution. Not a word, not a hint of it. They understood what it was. A kind of colonization of the human mind. A vision has to be a destiny far beyond winning, beyond money, beyond, as the gentleman said yesterday, schools should be about good health and money. For the question always reemerges, good health to what end? Money to what end? Why are we doing these things? Messy and as unpleasant as it will be for a practical people like Americans are, the sequence has to start with clear goals. And if the town can't provide you clear goals, or the state can't provide you clear goals, or the nation can't, then you've got to provide them for yourself. In a democracy worthy of the name, goals come from the bottom up, not the other way around. It will be messy if it's done right, because hundreds and thousands of separate agendas will be set in conflict by any attempt to change what is. And we will learn finally that we need multiple visions, many different curricula. There is no one right way. If I guess right, we don't have a choice. The present race is almost over. The whole food supply is in jeopardy, for one thing. Breeding stocks of fish along the California coast are at the lowest levels in history. Cape Cod Bay, where once fish were thick enough to walk across, is a dead sea in many places. The radical conclusion forces itself upon us that our oceans are dying. In Kansas, one bushel of irreplaceable topsoil blows away for every bushel of corn raised by factory farming methods, and that is true in all wheat and corn growing states. The food value of chemical agriculture's harvest is already much lower than the natural harvests of old-fashioned farming. If my guess is right, we need to construct a new vision of what education is, and we need new race courses on which to run that vision. The government can't do it for us. That's been tried for 140 years in monopoly schools, and they just got worse and worse. And the more tax money you surrendered, the worse the schools got. The two lines follow each other neatly on a graph. And they are correlated. If it could be fixed, it would have been fixed by now. There is no correlation between the play money of grades and the play money we buy things with, except the dishonest correlation that's forced on the job market by rigging it with arbitrary licensing laws and arbitrary hiring policies. For example, you can establish by law that the only people who can get into medical school are the people with lofty grade point averages, but that does not guarantee that the best people become doctors. The same unpleasant reality holds for lawyers or businessmen, engineers or school teachers. We have yet another warning that forcing the collective time of the American young into a contest for symbols, whether money symbols or grade symbols or similar prizes, is a mistaken course. And that warning is found again in the Proverbs of Solomon, in the haunting predictions of George Simmel, in the frightening reality of the American blood supply, and in the curious emergence of a national horde of lawyers who demonstrate our unhappiness. We do not trust each other. We do not like each other. We do not care for each other. We are unable to keep ourselves from encroaching on each other, and we cannot keep our promises. That is a recipe for social disaster. The new vision of American education is going to have to find a currency beyond money with which to pay its children to learn. My own experience, after 15 years of sponsoring volunteer projects for each one of my students, rich and poor, white and black, is that a curriculum that seeks the common good will be an important part of that real currency. Not all of it, but an important part of it. And a currency that doesn't inflate as grades do, one that holds its value. My own experience has been that every single academic question worth asking in any of the disciplines can be asked around a base of genuine service to genuine communities and can ride easily around an orbit of service. My own kids always did one full day of community service a week. They generally worked all alone in order to escape the culture of school children. They took on full adult responsibilities because I wouldn't allow the transaction to happen any other way. The community service program in District 4 that's been nationally trumpeted over this country as one of Ted Sizer's prize displays is an absolute fraud. It's 2 hours a week, and then they spend 2 days talking about the wonderful things they did. My kids took on full adult responsibilities, and they had a full adult work day even at the age of 12 or 13. And in almost every case, They discharged their duties splendidly. Even in the first year I experimented illegally with such a program, because I didn't bother to tell the school I was doing it, it worked. Indeed, it worked better for the selfish, spoiled, indifferent children of prosperous families than it did for the lost children of the poor and the non-college bound. But I'll tell you that it worked for both. The differences were small. It worked for everyone, including the communities which allowed themselves to be served. It transformed children spiritually, morally, and academically. In Western society over the past several thousand years, we've had at various times great social visions such as the one that I'm urging us to find now, or the many that I'm urging us to find now. We had the pagan vision of Stoics like Marcus Aurelius. We had the aristocratic vision of Charlemagne and the Plantagenet kings. We had the Christian vision of Saint Augustine, of Origen, and of the martyrs, and all these grand conceptions for which curricula were developed had a service ideal at the bedrock of their foundations. Although many of the details of these competing life curricula contradicted each other, at the base of all three was a service ideal, a sense that we were obligated to each other inextricably, that we needed to self-impose duty if we expect to live easily with others, not to have multicultural classrooms where you're told to love your neighbor, and the direct result of being told to love your neighbor is for you to despise your neighbor. That is the great secret we have lost sight of in schools built around a philosophy or a theology of materialism, a curriculum of competition an accumulation, a curriculum of self-aggrandizement, that these directives are prescriptions for bad individuals, bad communities, bad societies, and bad consciences. All the transforming visions we have human record of anywhere in the world ask a question beyond money. They ask, what do I owe, and how do I pay that debt? And in the answer to that question, I think the secret of our future lies. And these visions promise that if we will speak for those who cannot speak for themselves, if we will be generous to the poor, if we will seek the common good, that our lives will be filled with meaning. It worked for Solomon. It worked for my mother. It will work for the rest of us too. Thank you very much.
I hope you found this show rewarding and that it'll help you reflect on what kind of changes are really needed in the time ahead. I'm aware that I've spoken for longer on it than any of the other shows, so for that reason alone, I'd particularly value any thoughts you have. Send them either to me at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net or to the mailing list, which you can contact via altruists.org/unwelcome. All previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.